Boss Level is a podcast on people and organizations aiming for the boss level. Boss Level is a status a person or an organization achieves by making a better quality of life for themselves and others by doing what they need to do, regardless of all the haters and obstacles out there. This episode of Boss Level is brought to you by Nordic Business Forum, the greatest business show on earth. Speakers for the Nordic Business Forum in Sweden in January are being announced today. They include Chad Hurley, the co-founder and former CEO of YouTube, Chip Conley, the head of strategy at Airbnb, Andre Agassi, a tennis legend, and many others. Linda Lewis will also be on the stage. I had a chat with Linda on the podcast a few episodes back. If you missed it, you might want to check it out. And anyway, the super early bird tickets for Nordic Business Forum Sweden are available until Wednesday morning, April 13th. So act fast. Go to nbforum.com/Sweden to get your ticket. Okay, now let's get to the show. So, I'm in New York, and I'm at the office of a company called The Ready. And I'm sitting here with the founder, Aaron Dignan. So, welcome to the podcast, Aaron.
Thanks a lot.
So, to start off, tell me about The Ready. What do you guys do?
Yeah, so The Ready is really a company focused on the future of work. And it's a broad term that a lot of people throw around. But for us, it's really about this intersection between technology, complexity, and humanity, and the way that's shaping what we want the workplace to be and how organizations need to function to be successful. So The Ready is sort of an advisory consulting company, a coaching organization, if you will, to help organizations navigate that jump from the way they work today to the way they might work tomorrow.
Okay, so what's a normal engagement for you guys?
So it depends on the nature of the engagement, but the bulk of it are these sort of transformation projects where we work over the course of, 5 to 12 months with a business unit, a team of teams, if you will, yeah. And look at everything from their processes, their tools, their meeting types, their culture, their individual presence and wholeness, and sort of navigate how all those things fit together. We call it an operating system. So kind of what their OS is today, and then helping them find a path to what they want it to be tomorrow and then actually walk that path.
Okay, and is this like for big companies or medium-sized companies or startups or?
In the past, in my sort of past lives, it's been focused mostly on large sort of Fortune 500 type companies. But now with The Ready, my ambitions are a little different. So we do work with really large companies, but we also work with nonprofits and really fast-growing startups. What we found is that whether you're growing really fast or you are really big, you have sort of the same types of complexity and challenges in scale. So we try to work wherever the need is greatest.
Okay. And what's your background personally?
So I have a circuitous background, like many in our field, I guess. I started in molecular biology and genetics, moved into psychology, pursuing that as for my sort of degree work, which I never actually finished. Then I moved into psychology of brand and culting. Did 5 years of brand strategy workshops around the country with, brands of all shapes and sizes and brand experience planning, and then started to become fascinated with digital and what exponential technologies and disruptive technologies might do to culture. Moved into that space and started consulting on disruptive tech with large companies. And then over the course of maybe 5 years of doing that, realized that the problem wasn't how companies adapted to these technologies. It was that they couldn't, right? They were aware of it, but they weren't able to sort of move and pivot to take full advantage of what was happening. And I mean, that's still the case today. So I sort of fell in love with the problem of org design over the course of a decade and a half of doing other kinds of work.
So what do you think, what are the biggest problems or the obstacles that you're seeing in the companies that you work with nowadays?
I think it's a mix. So there's individual issues, right? In the sense that we don't feel comfortable being ourselves at work. So people have a work mask, a work life, they talk about work-life balance, all that kind of stuff. There's a separation of self that's going on. And that creates all sorts of interesting problems. in terms of how people show up and what kind of work they do and how they feel about the work they're doing. There's a second order problem then in the teams and how the teams function, whether they're functional or not. And then I think the most interesting challenge to me personally is that sort of third order challenge, which is when teams of teams get together and start to solve problems at scale, they become incredibly dysfunctional and they become incredibly slow to adapt. Which is interesting because you may have heard some of the data on when cities double in size, you know, inhabitants get more productive and more innovative. Yes. And interestingly, when companies double in size, the opposite happens. To me, that's such a fundamental disconnect, because although cities are where we live, organizations are where we do our work. And if the work that we need to do, whether that's, you know, dealing with climate change or you know, fixing the political system, or even just, you know, producing the next widget, yes, can't be done in the right way, it's a systemic and tremendous issue. So I think those things kind of all have a bit of an interplay.
So I think that's really interesting, saying that, like, the fact that cities, when they get big, they actually start working better, and companies fail to do that. What do you think that is? Why is it so different with companies?
Yeah, I think at some level, although we have, you know, government in a city and we have some sense of order or structure, there's just an enormous amount of freedom and flexibility for that system to learn. And I think inside most sort of corporate systems, we have a bias against learning because we're trying to eliminate failure. We're trying to predict and control the future. And as sort of the external context or the ecosystem that we operate in becomes more uncertain, more complex, more interconnected, that desire to control and sort of, you know, bind the organization in some kind of strategy and some kind of process and rigor backfires, essentially. There's sort of a threshold moment where when external change reaches a certain peak, you can no longer use that controlling ideology at the OS level, and then everything starts to really, you know, go backwards.
I think cities kind of see their role as enablers and as a platform for businesses and for individuals to do good things, and I guess what happens with corporations is they still want to stick with the control and they want to have it.
Yeah, I mean, imagine the perfect example is sort of thinking about a restaurant opening up on the corner, right? The restaurant opened up on the corner of the city. From the city's perspective, as long as it files the paperwork to make sure it doesn't burn the thing down, the restaurant can serve whatever it wants to serve. It can be whatever brand it wants to have. It can go out of business, and that's okay with the city, right? But from the business's perspective, we want to see the strategic plan for this restaurant, and the brand has to align with our brand, and the people have to do our training. And suddenly you've compressed this potential innovation engine that would have been a small unit of change out. And I think that the biggest thing that people don't understand is that almost every complex adaptive system that does do a good job of changing under volatility has a method for ensuring variation. It has a method for ensuring variance. And almost every big corporation has a method for eliminating variance.
And so now you mentioned complex adaptive systems, and just to get started with that, how would you define them? Like, what do you mean when you say complex adaptive systems?
So, well, I mean, you have to start by talking about the difference between complicatedness and complexity, which you might be familiar with or listeners might be. But essentially, you know, a complicated thing has a lot of parts, has a lot of connections, but ultimately can be understood, and we understand the relationship between the parts. So a watch is complicated. You know, if I move the dial, this is what's going to happen. I know how the pieces fit together and how they affect each other. A complex system is like traffic. Who knows what's going to affect what? And so that creates a different set of outcomes and a different way of interacting with that system, where you can't really be sure if you pull this lever or touch this, or they call it irritate the system in any way, what might actually happen on the other side. So complex systems have that trait. Complex adaptive systems have a few other traits. So they're not just complex, but they also have a large number of nodes or constituents or members in the system. They have no central authority, no central leader or control. So if you think about, you know, a hill of ants or your immune system, there's nobody driving the bus, essentially. The queen doesn't tell the ants what to do. So there's no central control. And then they have some mechanism for information flow through the system. So as they encounter information, there's a memory or a way of processing that information into a learning or a change in behavior. And so whether that's a conscious process or an unconscious process, there's a way by which information from the outside context is stimulating and changing the system itself. So those are the main traits that you see in the CAS.
And how is this useful for companies? If you understand more about complexity and more about like complex adaptive systems, how is this going to help you? How is it useful?
Well, I think you just have to start to draw the parallel. So you say, wait a second, if I have an organization of 10,000 people, yeah. Well, that's a lot of nodes. That's a lot of individual agents in the system making choices. I don't really believe in this day and age that I can control that system, right? I can nudge it, I can irritate it, but I can't really tell everybody what to do and expect a result. And even if I did, I might be wrong because the future is uncertain. So that might even be more dangerous. Yeah. On top of that, you know, if I limit the amount of central control and I let them galvanize in small tribes, groups of, you know, 150, what have you, now suddenly I have this sort of team of teams or this network effect. And then you start thinking about, well, what is our method for learning and processing information? So whether that's using new tools like Slack or, you know, cloud-based tools, or whether that's just simple processes like, you know, the popularity of the lean startup method or things like that. These are tools for processing information. They're algorithms, essentially. And I think the large organization, at least, not maybe at the cell level of 150, but at the level of thousands of people, it sort of wants to be algorithmic. It wants to be free to process, and it wants to be using a methodology that creates insight and replication of that insight at scale.
And you mentioned earlier that there's kind of a threshold, and that threshold we should kind of start letting go of control and move towards this like non-central authority type of organization. Do you think that there's such a threshold?
I think there's multiple thresholds, actually. Yeah. So I think that there, you know, you think about it as a fractal system. There's the individual, the team of teams, and the team of teams.
Yeah.
Those kinds of layers that go on. I think number one, you know, you have to think about, don't have structure beyond those layers I just described, right? So if you have a 7-layer or an 8-layer company, right off the bat, this is problematic because we don't have organizing concepts for scales beyond that as human beings in our heads, right? So, you know, I know about myself as an individual. I know about myself as a sitting at a table of seven and being part of a team. I even know about being part of a larger tribe. But then you start to run into these Dunbar's number type problems. Dunbar's number is the limit of how many people you can really know before you start to forget people's names and not know faces in the hallway. And, you know, it's debated how big it is, but it's somewhere between 150 and 300 people.
Yeah.
And then it's sort of like, I don't really know those other people, and I'm not really part of what they're part of. I don't really identify with them. And so the smarter systems out there, like a W.L. Gore, for instance, they actually limit the totality of a group that's functioning to around that scale. And they sort of say, as soon as we grow beyond that number, whether it's 150 or 250, now we're going to break the cell apart and we're going to let two, you know, independent autonomous cells be formed, and they're going to pursue different, you know, parts of the goal, and they'll actually have total autonomy to do that. So it's a choice to sort of, you know, reintegrate functions into a small cell and to not have a lot of interdependency or shared connections that that limit learning and that limit that identity.
And I guess one of the things that immediately comes to mind is like, if you do that, then won't you have the problem that you'll have two independent cells doing the same things or reinventing the wheel and so on.
Yeah, there's the efficiency argument, right? What if they do the same thing, or what if they don't row in the same direction?
Yes.
The reality is that's in my view of the world and in the view of, you know, sort of complexity scientists, that trade-off is a worthwhile trade-off, essentially. You'd rather have a little bit of redundancy in the system than fail entirely and have a catastrophic breakdown. You'd rather have a little bit too much divergence on strategy than not enough, and not have enough new ideas and innovation in the system. So it's a worthwhile expense, I guess, in the grand scheme of things, but it's not well aligned with our current kind of capitalist manifesto.
Yeah, because it's horrible if we do something twice.
Right. Yeah. God forbid. And it's sort of the difference between efficiency and effectiveness,
yes,
right?
Yes, of course.
You know, if you want it to make money, that's a goal. If you want it to survive for a long time, that's a goal. Being effective at those two things might not be the same thing as being capital efficient, you know, on a granular level of a team or an idea.
And also there's the assumption that, like, if you come up with something once, then it's the perfect solution.
Yeah.
And no one can ever add to that by inventing it again.
Well, end, it goes back to the variation piece. So all these systems that we talked about, they create variation. They see how the variation performs. This is sort of evolution, right, in the environment. And then they replicate the ones that do well. Well, if you just pick one way of doing HR and then you only do that for 10 years, you've completely eliminated that learning function. And the sort of incremental learning that occurs inside a single model is good, but it's not good enough. It doesn't create those sort of wild leaps in productivity or wild leaps in learning that you see in other systems.
Yeah. So let's say that that you're starting to work with a new company and the point is to transform more towards this like no central authority and so on. Where do you start? How do you get started with the whole thing?
Interestingly, you have to start with leadership.
Well, that's a surprise.
Yeah, because I mean, you know, wherever the power lies, you're not really getting rid of power, you're transferring power, right? So yeah. You have to find the seat of power in order to move it. And in this case, you're transferring it to a process or a set of ideals or a set of principles, or you're transferring it literally to other people in the organization. So we usually start with leaders, not that that's where the real meat of the work happens, but it's a priming opportunity. So we work with a leadership team doing some intervention, some immersion, some workshopping, and then ultimately just some team coaching, because we find more often than not, teams at the top are not really teams at all. We're so functionalized and so divided as corporations now that if you get an HR leader, two P&L leaders, a finance leader, they actually don't do anything together as a team. Yeah. Like they barely get together at all. And so there's this opportunity to just team and then see, you know, what kinds of things come from that cross-pollination. And then there's a lot of interrogating this theory that needs to go on at that level. So, you know, if we're ceding any power or we're changing dynamics, what exactly is this? How does it work? How does it feel? So all that work happens first. And then from there, we really move into, you know, one or two different forms of piloting. So that could be finding groups that are disparate throughout the organization to start to pilot and learn how some of this stuff lands. Because at the end of the day, you're trying to mix external theory with internal culture, right? So you don't want to come in with a cookie cutter solution. It won't work. At the same time, a lot of the principles are common, you know, between companies that work in a new way. So we want to bring the principles in and then say, how do these fit and mold to this culture and how do you make them your own? That happens in a piloting process. And sometimes that happens spread throughout the sort of range and layers and span of the organization. And sometimes it happens in a specific P&L that's carved out in its totality. And sometimes it happens top down. So you kind of do a cascading effect. And it just depends on the context and what people are trying to do and how fast they're trying to do it. All those things.
So basically, you first create a cross-functional team from the leadership and from maybe from other parts of the organization, and then you start doing pilots.
Yeah, it's not, I mean, you know, everybody always kind of goes back to Kotter's 8 steps, but it's not that dissimilar. I mean, there's a reason that's stuck around for a while. You have to figure out what's wrong and sort of, you know, figure out what the urgency is. You have to build a coalition. You have to, you know, create some urgency. You have to go out and get small wins or demonstrate proof. And then, you know, dominoes start to fall.
What we do is exactly the same. I mean, just create the cross-functional team. And it's crazy how much you can get with simply just gathering people from different parts of the organization, getting them on the same table and just start experimenting with something to like improve on together. It's crazy what just happens as a result of just that.
Yeah, it's funny. I have a former colleague who's now starting a software company actually called Parabol. But he always jokes that like just doing a weekly kind of action or tactical meeting that's well facilitated for a team every week is like the most transformative thing in business, which is crazy.
Yeah,
but it's true.
Yeah, and just once again reminds me, we had this conversation with Håkan Fors, who's a consultant in Sweden, and we had this conversation about like what's a minimum viable company. So what would be like a single practice that you would pick if you started a company, and we ended up with just having retrospectives would probably be that. Because you can generate anything out of that.
Yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense. Looking back, looking ahead, and especially now with all these sort of decentralized autonomous organizations and things based on the blockchain and, you know, new types of collaboration, that MVP concept will be tested.
Yes. Okay. So you mentioned in the beginning, you mentioned technology, you mentioned complex adaptive systems, and then you mentioned humanity. So if we go into technology, how do you think, or what are your thoughts on how is that changing organizations?
Well, I think, I mean, technology is doing a couple things at the same time. And obviously, whether this is all good or bad is a philosophical conversation that we can also get into if you want. but one of the things it's done is it's changed our ability to move information around. I mean, that's why they call it information technology. And this, of course, has opened up the possibility of having larger, complex adaptive systems. So before, we had a limit in terms of how information could move and be shared. And now that some of those barriers are being broken down. So whether that's, you know, one-to-many communication like on Twitter or Facebook, or whether that's many-to-many inside a system like Slack, having a layer of data that can be transmitted, that can be tagged, that can be routed, you know, all that is creating a potential for more learning. So that's one piece of it. It's just the information level has created an opportunity to do more and maybe operate at a larger scale while still being effective. The second thing that it's done is sort of change what we can do in what amount of time, right? So barriers have been dropped. If you look at how long it takes to build a company today that maybe touches a billion people, you know, that number keeps going down and down and down because we can build on the platforms of others. So it's a much more scalable set of value creation. You know, in the past, if I built a hotel, one person could use the lobby at a, you know, or the conference room at a time, right? Or one person could use a room at a time. Now, if I build AWS, suddenly millions of companies can leverage that. So we have this economy now where we're sort of standing on each other's shoulders, which creates more scale and also a faster progress in terms of what we can do and how we can deploy it. So that increases the external context in terms of rate of change. And that's actually been, I think, the big kind of gateway drug to this opportunity to change the way we work. Because once that rate of change spun up past a certain RPM, it sort of broke everything. And now, you know, now we have to react to that breakage. So I think that's, you know, that's a fundamental issue as well. So we kind of look at how those two things, the movement of information and the, you know, capacity to sort of use and share and leverage technology has affected culture and affected, you know, individual businesses, and see that as a major ingredient in what's to come.
And actually, this just reminded me of the, like, the whole transparency discussion and how, for example, Buffer is releasing all the salaries of all employees publicly, which is, it's crazy. I mean, if you think about that happening like 40 years ago.
It would have shocked the system.
And I think it still shocked the system. And they released them in 2014 or 2015 or something. So what are your thoughts on transparency?
I mean, in general, I'm a big fan of transparency. I think that the... you know, if you have the advantage of starting something from scratch, you get to choose transparency from the outset. And that's a lot easier because it's sort of developmentally built into the ideology of the company. So it feels very normal and very comfortable. I think the risk that maybe is talked about a little less is that if you're not transparent and you have maybe 100 years of cultural legacy, it's more dangerous to just flip the switch, right? You can't just suddenly flip the switch, or you create all this kind of tumult in the system, which some would argue is good in the sense that now kind of the truth is out. And I don't disagree with that. But if you're trying to navigate for success, you want to do that progressively and sort of take steps in the direction of transparency over time to, you know, minimize how you destabilize the system. But generally, the value of the transparency goes back to the uncertainty, right? So if we don't know what's valuable, if we don't know what information will unlock insight, if we don't know who needs to know what or who should, in quotes, know what, then transparency is our only option. It's our only hope, because we have to assume that people will then pull and seek out the information they need, that they will see things others didn't see, that it will create, you know, new insights and outcomes, and also that it creates, you know, more equality and fairness, right? Because now we don't have pay gaps and other nonsense that still persists, at least in this country.
Is there a limit to it? I mean, is transparency, like, more and more transparency always better?
This is a great question. I think people are testing that idea right now. Yeah. I think that transparency and trust go hand in hand. So if you have a high trust, safe environment, then I would sort of argue that maybe there isn't a limit to, as long as those two move in parallel, maybe there isn't a limit to the value, right? Because it just increases wholeness, presence, empathy, understanding, reality. Now, there's a big difference between things being accessible and things being put in your face. So I, you know, maybe I'd like to be able to look up how you slept last night so I can be empathetic to you. But I don't necessarily want that in my inbox in the morning, right? So I think the biggest balance here is information overload and figuring out how to have a push-pull system that gets you the right data when you need it in order to be a more whole, more empathetic, more insightful member of a collective.
I actually think that Zach Holman from GitHub, he wrote this blog post about opt-in transparency, where that was exactly that idea, that it's actually a really bad thing to have everything like broadcast to everyone all the time, because that's just going to be a huge mess. But his point was like that it's opt-in, that there's like, if you ask for any data in the company, you can have it, but it won't be handed to you if you don't ask for it.
Right, right. It's interesting too, because I've spent a lot of time arguing with myself about locality in systems. So if you look at most complex adaptive systems that have simpler agents, simpler than humans by far, all the information is transparent, but only locally. So you can see all the information, but only around you. You can't really see system-wide information as a member of those systems. So it's all about acting locally, thinking locally, reacting to local information. And only through the hive mind do you see global understanding and global directionality. So think about a flock of birds, for instance, right? There's nobody really seeing the whole. They only see the birds around them. So that's made me puzzled about what's the metaphor or the parallel for locality in business. In organizations, you know, is that what you ask for, or is it what is in your team? Who, you know, is it in your Dunbar's number group? Like, where does that transparency sort of need to be perfect versus where can it maybe be less perfect?
I also noticed that you also do some angel investing.
Yeah, sure.
And one of the things that I sometimes struggle with is that, like, what's better? Is it better to try to help the big companies change, which is really slow and painful and so on? And then there's the other part of trying to help startups overtake those companies.
Yeah, yeah.
And what are your thoughts on that? Which one is more meaningful for the world?
So I think I've thought about this a lot over the last decade, and I actually think it's a false choice.
Okay.
So for a while there, it looked like, oh, we just, you know, let's invest in the new stuff because it'll eat the dinosaurs and then everything will be great.
Yeah.
But I think what we've seen with Zenefits, with Uber, with others is maybe it won't be great. Maybe these problems of scale, these problems of pace of growth are going to plague everybody until we have a new playbook, right? So just because, a company like Uber is disruptive doesn't mean that the way they're structured and the way they treat people is disruptive. And in fact, I actually think the way they structure themselves is pretty smart when you think about kind of treating each city as a node and as a cell and giving the cities, you know, a degree of autonomy. I haven't been inside the system enough to evaluate it fully, but there's some promising ideas there about local direction and influence. On the other hand, you know, there's still a lot of command and control culture in a place like that, you know, it matters that there's a leader. There is clearly a leader and there's clearly kind of a dominant set of ideas. So I think we still have to ask ourselves, even if we go all in on startups, won't they just become end ups over time? And if we can't figure out how to help the end ups, then maybe we don't know how to help ourselves. So I like to play both sides of the aisle. I think they actually help each other a lot. So one of my favorite things to do is put a startup I invested in with a client that I work with and figure out how they can help each other. So I think there's a lot of learning all the way around, but I don't think you can just ignore the big and focus on the small, nor do I think you can just focus on the big and ignore the small. I think you really have to play the whole spectrum.
Okay, so don't pick, just do both.
Don't pick, yeah. Figure out, and then maybe you pick a vertical or you pick a thing you're passionate about. You're passionate about healthcare, great, go healthcare. But then look at what's happening at the top and the bottom and figure out what are the dynamics that affect everybody.
Yeah. So what are you currently like interested in, or what are you studying or going, like where are you finding new information?
Yeah, I mean, I read everything I can get my hands on, like many of us do. So I have 15 different readers on my phone and I bring them all up and try to read everything I see, which helps a lot. But at the end of the day, you know, a lot more is interesting conversations that I have, like this one, or ones that, you know, after a conference over a drink where we find out what's bubbling up. I think unlike maybe 5 years ago, the most interesting things happening right now are known. They're popularized by the media, but we don't yet talk enough about what they actually mean. So for most people that are nerdy right now, they're like, oh, blockchain, you know, blockchain, pshaw. Yeah, of course. Blockchain's like I wish everyone would shut up about blockchain. But like, take a step back and just think about the fact that 95% of Americans have no idea what it is, right?
Probably
maybe higher than that,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Number two, neither do you, really. Yeah. We don't even know what it could be, how it could change corporate structure, governance, the flow of money, resources, information, etc. You see things like Slockit or Ethereum happening, and you're like, man, there's a huge problem space and opportunity space there that we're so blasé about what's hot now that we almost just walk right over the interesting opportunities. So for me, the things I'm interested in right now are autonomous systems like autonomous cars, blockchain, machine learning and deep learning in environments where, you know, human traits, behavior, personality comes in. I invested last year in a company called Crystal that does personality profiles based on scraping language that you've used on the internet and then uses that to help you communicate better. So things like that are really interesting to me. But yeah, I don't think there's some kind of secret wave of things that people don't know about anymore. I think it's the web's too transparent for that. Yeah. It's really just a question of like who will get it right.
Yeah, yeah. I love blockchain, how it's become something that's like it's all over and there's just so much talk about it and so few actual implementations on top of it. It's just like,
yeah. Well, I think that's the world. Like the whole, you know, hype cycle thing has gotten even more parabolic lately, where it's just like we take something that has a very small instance of use and limited understanding and we turn it into the front page, you know, of a magazine of Wired. And then before it even finds itself, we're on to the next thing.
Yeah. So I guess if you wanted to start a startup, you'd add in like a blockchain, then IoT, and then make it self-organized and all that kind of stuff. And you'd have the perfect startup, only that you'd only have solutions, not a problem that it would solve. But
right. Yeah, just be full of solutions. No, I still think the killer app is just a conference call that doesn't sound like crap. Yeah, everyone's in for that, right? Like a call that doesn't get dropped, right? That's the killer app. Make a call doesn't get dropped, Verizon.
This was one of the several awesome interviews I did while visiting New York. You'll be hearing the rest throughout the second season of Boss Level, so a lot of great stuff coming up. Stay tuned for the next episode in 2 weeks. Thanks for listening.